Night with Rick Ballew on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Monday, and a great week for you and yours off of a phenomenal weekend. I mean, just electrifying. We had golf, we had hockey, we had hoops, baseball, college and pro, Olympic trials. Congratulations to Garrett Scantling, known as Daddy for a number of years. His brother Hunter was a pitcher for Florida State, going back a few years as well. I know he played over at Georgia, but just thrilled to, you know, see that. I haven't watched a lot of Olympic trials because I've been, you know, really focused on the NHL more than anything after the United States Open. But just a great weekend, and I think it's going to be a good week as well. Got a lot to do here over the next 5 days as we find ourselves all of a sudden the 21st day of June. I mean, you got to be kidding me. Stop. I mean, just slow it down. Telling you what, before you know it, it'll be July 27th, and we'll be talking about Jaguars football and training camp 2021. I do have something that I'm going to dive into tonight on the Jags, which I will ask for your participation. That is coming up momentarily. Got to begin, though, with John Rahm. Congratulations to the 26-year-old Spaniard, the first ever from Spain to win a United States Open, a tournament that has been dominated by Americans as of late. And I thought the theater on Sunday was absolutely phenomenal. You know, it reminded me of last year in San Francisco at the PGA Championship. And what stood out then was Colin Morikawa went out and won it. Okay, didn't lay up like Louis Oosthuizen did yesterday on 18. And I like Louis. I'm a big Oosthuizen guy. I mean, for crying out loud, he's got six runner-ups in majors. He's only won it once. You know, a lot of people forget when they talk about the great Jack Nicklaus, the 18 majors, he had 19 second place finishes. I mean, think about that. John Rahm, for a very long time, has been considered, well, it hasn't been that long of a time because he's only 26, but for the last half decade, he has been considered arguably the best player on the PGA Tour to not have won a major. And all of a sudden, you look at his numbers and they're absolutely spectacular. Get this. Six PGA Tour wins now for John Rahm in his first major. But he has 108 career starts on the PGA Tour. 51 of those 108, he has a top 10. A top 10 finish in 51 of 108 starts. So you can do the math. That's nearly 50%. He's got 72 out of 108 top 25 finishes. So he cashes checks whenever he tees off. But what I loved about this is his way that he played the golf course, particularly the back nine. He tried to win it. It felt like, you know, I don't want to give you a team analogy to compare it to the PGA Tour, but we go back to the AFC Championship game when the Jaguars were trying to win in Foxborough, okay? They weren't trying to win that game. They were trying to hang on, right? I mean, it was so damn, take a knee with 55 seconds left before half. Everyone, no matter where you were, whether you were at the game, at a bar, on your lazy boy, you knew exactly what the Jaguars were going to do offensively in the second half, especially the fourth quarter. They didn't try to win the game. They tried to get out of there by running clock, and, of course, the third and 18 crushed them outside of the Miles Jack wasn't down. It was the biggest play in the football game. But if you go back and Doug Peterson, who's now, you know, he's recently been fired, which is just mind-boggling to me, considering he won a Super Bowl just a couple of years ago in Philly. Doug Peterson tried to win. Nick Foles, they tried to win. Gimmick plays, going for it on fourth down. I mean, they weren't there to hang on. They were there to try to go for the victory. And that's what John Rahm did yesterday. And to make those two clutch putts on the 71st and 72nd hole is exactly what this game needs. So congratulations to John Rahm. I mean, he's a guy that has irritated a lot of people over the years, wears his emotions on his sleeve, which, for the record, I can appreciate. I know golf is such a gentleman's sport and you're not allowed to do this and do that. I like it when athletes show emotion, okay? I was talking to you about the Boston Celtics, what, 2-3 weeks ago, RJ, when the Celtics lost, they were just going through the motions. They didn't even look upset. Now we hear that that was a, you know, dysfunctional locker room. Brad Stevens is no longer the coach. He was upstairs. They've already made a trade with Kemba Walker. But typically in professional or collegiate athletics, no matter what the team sport is, they make a mistake. They screw up. They show their emotion. On the golf course, it's like, no, respect the game. The gods are listening. And, you know, John Rahm used to fire clubs, used to throw stuff all across the course, upset a lot of people. He's calmed down now. He's a young father. But I got to give him a lot of credit for completely changing his attitude on the golf course, and I think the end result, he picked up a lot of fans yesterday.
I believe that he did, and he showed great poise and great composure. However, to just ask a question even relating to golf, doesn't it always feel that golf is that sport, though? That you have to be the calm, cool, collected one? Because, I mean, you know, the fans can't roar, scream, and cheer after every putt and every golf swing, as opposed to other sports where everything's just so in the moment. It's more or less in golf, you have to be that calm, yep, and have that demeanor about yourself.
Right, right, right. But there's different ways to win. And congratulations, by the way, you selected John Rahm.
Sir!
I'm going to start really going after you for your golf analysis.
But don't go to me.
Are you kidding me? You can't go wrong.
Well, listen, I'm on a 2-game winning streak. I think I should retire while I'm ahead.
Hideki Matsuyama won the Masters by bogeying 3 out of his last 4 holes. Okay. To me, that's comparable to the Jaguars running it all 4 drives in the fourth quarter against New England. Again, you could be on your, you know, 27th Schlitz malt liquor bowl, and you absolutely knew that they were going to run it on first down and pass it on second down, and then incomplete on third down. Punt. I mean, it was so damn predictable. A lot of these golfers, same thing, man. They take what the golf course gives them. Justin Thomas here on a Sunday went for it. Colin Morikawa a year ago in San Francisco at the PGA Championship, he went for it. John Rahm, same thing. Now, there are others. Brooks Koepka, he went for it. Had the, you know, on the par 3 coming in, missed badly to the left of the green. Bryson DeChambeau, a major malfunction, and how much fun is he to watch? I mean, you really never know what you're going to get out of Bryson DeChambeau. He looks like such a lughead out there, and, you know, I'm a big fan of his game, but you just don't know. He put up a frosty, for crying out loud. I mean, a legitimate 8, and you look at Bryson DeChambeau, he had gone 30 consecutive holes without a bogey and was at 5 under. And then he fell apart on 11 and 12. And then again, he had the, double bogey. Did Bryson DeChambeau on 13. And then, of course, you know, he had an 8 on, I think it was 15 or 16, where that actually did happen. I'll have to look back on it for Bryson DeChambeau. But, you know, I just thought it was thrilling golf. And 6-under wins it. That was the exact score I predicted, for what it's worth. I'm never one to pat myself on the back. As you know, I just gave credit to RJ Saunders for winning it by picking John Rahm. My 2, Koepka, Morikawa, I thought they had chances. They didn't get it done. And that's what was so interesting about this year's PGA Tour. I really thought at one point yesterday, you could make a case for 13 different golfers who actually had a chance. I mean, I remember watching Brooks Koepka. He birdied the first hole, or it was either the first or second hole for Koepka. It was hole number two. He went out with a 32. He had birdies on 2, 8, and 9. They could, you know, 5 strokes. Is that enough for Brooks? Can he get there? And sure enough, he had his opportunities. You know, he missed some greens, and the putting didn't work for Brooks Koepka the way that it should have. Think of how much money was made in Las Vegas if you took Brooks Koepka in the head-to-head with Bryson DeChambeau. I mean, we talked to Rafael Esparza about that, you know, Wednesday night live from MyBookie and MyBookie.com, that's what most people were wagering on, the head-to-head, even though they weren't going up against one another. Boy, did that change quickly. Bryson DeChambeau is 5 under par and leading the United States Open. Then he has a complete meltdown after a 2-under-33 going out with no bogeys. Again, bogeys on 11, 12, double bogey on 13, and the Frosty on the par 4, 17th. Bryson DeChambeau shot a 44 coming in. Tough to believe. That's 8 over par. Just amazing. All right, we got a lot to do tonight. We're going to relive this a little bit, talk more about golf. And, you know, John Rahm, very happy for him. You know, I think lost in all this is just how well he handled himself this month. I mean, he had a 6-shot lead at Jack's tournament. He had 18 holes to go. He was up by 6 shots at the Memorial. And it cost him, what, $1.5 million? He had to get himself, you know, he was removed from the tournament because he tested positive for COVID. Just put yourself in those shoes for a minute. All right, and really consider how other golfers or anyone else in sports could have gone the different way. They could have blamed everyone from the PGA Tour to the folks there at the Memorial. He didn't, man. He took the high road. He was humble. He said it was 100% his fault. He took all responsibility and shown up with outstanding character and went out and won the major. I have a lot more respect today now for John Rahm than I did when this tournament began on Thursday. And I liked him then. But now it's like he made a fan of me. And I got to imagine that there's many other golf fans out there who feel the same way by the way that he got it done over the last 4 days. All right, we're going to have a very busy week. It's great to have you with us. I am Rick Ballew alongside RJ Saunders. That is my take. It is brought to you by my good buddy Lou Bodie. Okay, he is with Capital Financial Strategies. He is an investment specialist and senior financial advisor, and he has been so for 20 years right here in Jacksonville. His practice is centered on financial planning and education for his clients. This includes strategies on investments and retirement. Give Lou a phone call today. It's local, 626-7995, 626-7995, Lou Bodie, Capital Financial Strategies. When we come back, a little bit more on this. Now, let's get into the Jags a little bit. I mentioned it with Frank and company. How many more can they score this year? How many less will they give up? If you don't know what I'm talking about, good. I'll explain next.
It's incredible that I'm sitting next to this trophy, you know. A couple weeks ago, I watched my good friend Phil win the PGA, and I took a lot of inspiration from that. Having closed before, I just knew on a Sunday, the way I had been playing on the Sundays the last few majors, I just had to be close, and I knew I could get it done. Man, I got it done in a fashion that apparently only can happen to me at Torrey Pines.
Into the Night with Rick Ballew on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
All right, John Rahm's first win of the PGA Tour was a few years ago back at Torrey Pines. He wins his first major. Great to have United States Open back at the South Course for the first time since Tiger won it on a busted leg in 2008. Great leaderboard, a lot of theater. I mean, Harris English kind of snuck in late. I think he had an eagle. Actually, he had 3 birdies, final 5 holes. coming in, the former dog. But John Rahm, Louis Oosthuizen, you look at Brooks Koepka, Colin Morikawa. Obviously, Bryson DeChambeau dropped off late. Sergio Garcia really struggled late. I mean, they all had opportunities. Not Sergio Garcia, excuse me, Rory McIlroy. Ended up at one under par, double bogey on 12, bogey on 11, and a bogey on 16. But I just thought it was great and very excited that the tournament went as is. You know, one note that is kind of a sad one, and I had a couple people, you know, light me up before the weekend when I made the point that there was no way that Richard Bland would, you know, win this tournament. And I got the obligatory, anyone can win it. Why are you counting out this man? Well, the reason why I counted him out, because he's Richard Bland. Okay? That's why I counted him out. But I did feel bad when you look at the fact that the winner, John Rahm, brings home $2,250,000, okay? Richard Bland, who ended up shooting 8 over, tied for 50th, brought home $27,327,000. I mean, you had to have thought at least he was going to bring in, you know, top 12, top 15 money. If he finished 15th, he would have made $177,000. I have no idea what the bank account looks like for Richard Bland. I know he plays overseas, but my understanding is that he has really been a journeyman. This could have been a tremendous opportunity for him to really line his pockets, and he didn't. I mean, again, it's, you know, $27,000 is not bad for 4 days' work. But the point I'm trying to make is he really could have gone deep into six digits. And it got away from him, particularly with the putting, both Saturday and Sunday. All right, more on golf coming up here in just a little bit. Certainly going to give you an opportunity to voice your opinion on what you saw over the last 4 days. Tonight's show is brought to you by Key Buick GMC. They got something wonderful going on right now. You lease a vehicle, okay? Bring it by right now to Key. Get a free appraisal. Also an equity evaluation. They will pay your lease off early, okay? Don't wait. You need to go in now, this week. They are currently at Key buying all makes, all models. The market conditions right now are really increasing the value of your vehicle. So come see what your car is worth. Go by, visit Steve or Derek, a couple of real good guys over there at Key Buick GMC, right across the street from Tinseltown, Southside and Gate. We are professional grade. So a good opportunity for you right now to do that. If you're stuck in a lease and you're unhappy with it, just go by Key Buick GMC. All right, let's switch up our attention a little bit to the NFL, because I've been sitting on this a little bit, and you know, I want to get it out at the right time, and I think today is a good day for it on this Monday, this kind of rainy Monday, because this to me is obviously the most important factor for the 2021 Jacksonville Jaguars. This was a terrible football team last year, and I don't care which way you look at it. Even in a world where, you know, we can cook books and find a way to make something look positive, you can't. You just can't with this team a year ago. It was just awful. So here's what I got for you, and you know, I'd appreciate an honest assessment from you on it, okay? With diehard Jaguar fans out there, always the best way to get a hold of me is on the text line. That is 641-1010, brought to you by Lifetime Enclosures, or you can get me on Twitter, Baloo1010XL. The Jaguars last year scored 19.1 points a game, 30th in the NFL. Okay, we know over the last 2 years, they're averaging just a smidge over 8 points a game in the first 30 minutes of play. What does that mean? You begin the third quarter, they're always trailing by a touchdown, maybe two. They become one-dimensional, whatever. All right. I think this is a markedly improved offense. I feel that way. But is it going to necessarily generate many more points on the field? 19.1 is what they scored last year. What's an honest number that you can expect the Jaguars to give you each and every Sunday? 17 Sundays this year, as we know. We have an additional game. I mean, if you just throw out 25, folks, 6 points a game is an enormous upgrade. And I'm not saying that that's out of the realm of possibility. But this is what I want to hear from you on, because I think it's a serious question of the Jaguar fans. You know, you need to look at it this way. Obviously, the game is scoring points and giving up points. Well, last year, Jacksonville gave up 30.8 points a game, nearly 31 points a game. The average score last year for Jacksonville was basically 31-19, and they were on the other side. So I guess if you don't give it any thought, you can just say to me, all right, Blue, I got them scoring 5 more points a game, you know, going from 19.1 to 24.1 or 25.1. And yeah, Blue, 30.8, I got them giving up 5 less a game, so they'll give up 25.8 a game. Okay, it's not that simple. It's not. I certainly right now feel much better about this team offensively than I do defensively. I still think there are visible warts on this defense. Okay? The number one issue, in my opinion, for this defense is you got to stop the run. And, you know, they gave up 153.3 yards a game last year against the run. That is just such an incredible embarrassment, really, of a group of men. That they would allow that amount of rushing yards. In the last 3 years combined, remember how great this defense was? You know, 16, 17, and 18. The last 3 years, or you know, really 16 and 17, they were even decent in 18. But always their defense against the run was in those years where they were consistently top five in scoring defense, top five in total defense. The rushing yards allowed was where they would rank the worst out of any defensive statistic. The last 3 years, Jacksonville's given up 137 yards a game. All right, that's 31 out of 32 teams. So the point I'm trying to get at here is, without any question, to me, the biggest thing that needs to be fixed more than anything else on this football team is Jacksonville defending the run. And I think they've done a nice job. You know, they've gone out and they've added you know, Roy Robertson Harris. They made the trade for Malcolm Brown. They happen to think that Jay Tufele is going to be able to come in and immediately be a part of that rotation. You know, the return to health of Devon Hamilton. They re-signed Smoot. You know, the right things were said last week by Tosh Lapoy about Taven Bryan. You know, we'll see. You know, they added a guy on the edge like Jahad Ward. So the point I'm trying to make is I feel better about the Jaguars defending the run. It's a better group than a year ago. And I also think if Jacksonville can do things like, oh, I don't know, take a lead? Am I allowed to say that at 6:31? The Jaguars actually grab a lead?
Is it possible?
I mean, what? What did they go, like 16, 17 straight games without scoring a touchdown on their first drive? Remember, I was harping about it every week. I was a broken record on a Monday.
Yeah, and it's irritating to me.
I could have sat at home.
Exactly.
And you could have just run, you know, my monologue from the week prior. Jaguars open up a game, go 3-and-out. Hand off to James Robinson. He'll get 4, 2nd-and-6. Back to pass. It's... what's his name this week? It's Jake Luton. It's Gardner Minshew. It's Mike Glennon. That's incomplete. 3rd-and-6. They dumped down to LaVisca Chenault. Looks like he's going to get about 2 yards. Punting! Okay. Same old, same old, same old. Jacksonville doesn't start fast. So let's say they do this year. And let's say this offense can run. let's say this offense can move the ball in the air. Let's say they can put together double-digit drives, 10-play, 11-play, 12-play drives. You know, move 75 yards, find pay dirt, move 70-whatever yards, settle for a field goal. Take some clock. That'll change things. That'll be better for the run defense for two reasons. Number one, if you get ahead, teams are going to be forced to do whatever it takes to expose the Jaguars, not just run it down their throat like they did a year ago. And number two, you know, that creates an opportunity when things like that happen where possibly there could be more turnovers. The Jaguars were really bad last year in the whole, you know, turnover takeaway margin. So I feel much better about the run defense. I'm still really concerned about who's going to get to the quarterback. Okay. 18 sacks, 16 games. I know there's a new defensive scheme. I don't know what to expect. I mean, who's going to lead this team in sacks? I have a feeling most would say Josh Allen. And coming off an injury-plagued year, you know, Roy Robertson-Harris had no sacks last year in eight games in Chicago. A lot of people were putting that on him. Jahard Ward. And what does Jahard Ward have? I think eight career sacks in 52 games? Okay, it's exactly what he has. DeJuan Smoot led the team last year in sacks with 5.5. Taven Bryan has 3.5 sacks in 48 games. Kalevon Chaisson last year had one sack. Was he playing out of position? Yes. Is he going to be playing in a more natural position as a Sam linebacker this year? Yes. But I'm still really concerned about who in the heck is going to get to the quarterback. And, you know, the end result of that is if you can't get to the quarterback, I don't care how much your defensive contain has improved, your secondary has improved. If you're not getting to the quarterback, teams are going to expose you. So the point I'm making, I feel good about the offense and what they've done on paper and what I've had a chance to see during limited media access. The defense, not so much. So where does that all go if you're nearly 12 points more allowing than you are getting? How much closer within those 12 points can you get? Can the offense go from 19.1 to 25 points? Man, that's, you know, that's 6 points a game. Would you take that? I mean, if that was the Vegas line right now, average 25 points a game over 17 games, I would have to take the under. I just can't see them improving 6 points a game. That's a huge leap. I think somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 22, 23 is realistic. Again, give me your opinion on this. 641-1010. If you want to tell me why, throw in a couple of particulars, love to hear from you. On the other side, defense. Again, I think they're better against the run. I don't think they can get to the quarterback. They allow basically 31 a game. How far are you going to move them up this year? I mean, if this defense goes from allowing 31 a game to 28 a game, that's a three-point improvement. That may be the difference in winning two, three more games. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, does it? That if you had the Jaguars scoring 25 a game now and allowing 28, I kind of feel the vibe. That's not good enough for you. But what I'm trying to tell you, if those were the numbers, you have the Jacksonville offense improving by 6 points. You have the Jacksonville defense allowing three less points a game. That's a 9-point improvement. That's an awful lot, ladies and gentlemen. Over a 17-game schedule. Okay, so that's what I've come up with. We'll get it from you, RJ, on the other side. But tell me what you honestly believe here, because, you know, this is where you can use your analytics. This is where you can play the role of Bryson DeChambeau and you know, put some science into this. because this is what it is truly all about. How much more are you going to score, and how many fewer are you going to give up? All right. 641-1010 on the text line, also on Twitter, Ballou, B-A-L-L-O-U, 1010-XL.
Let's go into the night with Rick Ballou on 1010-XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, we're keeping an eye on the Braves matchup against the Mets. Jake DeGrom on the hill. 5 innings, 1 hit, struck out 6. That minuscule ERA is dropping. Matter of fact, it's only dropped 0.4 in 5 innings. That's how small his ERA is. He went from 0.54 to 0.50. Pitch count is respectable. It's 70. 1-0 right now. Mets. This is a crazy year in baseball. You could have, you know, DeGrom win the Cy Young by honestly winning 10, 11, 12 games. And I know he's done that before. In the American League, here's one for you. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. could win the Triple Crown. I don't think he will. I just think it's too hard. We saw, you know, Miggy Cabrera do it a few years ago, and I want to say the last guy to do it before Miggy Cabrera was, you know, Carl Yastrzemski in the late 60s. It might have been 1970. It just doesn't happen. But Vladimir Guerrero Jr. could win the Triple Crown this year in the American League and not win the MVP because of Ohtani. I mean, how crazy is that?
That's crazy. All right? That is crazy. Would you still say... would you say Ohtani is the better player than Vlad overall, and that's why they would try to give him the MVP? Because you know what?
Nah, I'm going to take Vlad.
Okay, because, you know, my argument being an NBA guy, I understand Jokic played the most games out of any other player this season, but I thought Chris Paul should have been the MVP, what he did
right
this season. So, I'm, you know, does better player just automatically mean, yeah, we got to give him the MVP, or should it be, hey, you're having the best year this year. If you're going to have a guy that's going to win the Triple Crown, maybe he needs to be in the running or at least leading the clubhouse for MVP.
He's the modern-day Babe Ruth. We haven't seen anyone do it since Babe Ruth. And if you look at Ohtani's numbers pitching, they dwarf Babe Ruth. You know, obviously, offensively, Ruth hit many more home runs, but... yeah, I think a lot of it will depend on where the team finishes right now. The Angels are even at 500, and, you know, they release Pujols, so Mike Trout is hurt. You look at Toronto, they're kind of up and down, 4-6 in their last 10. They're 7 games out in the American League East. But, yeah, I would take Guerrero Jr. by a slight nod over Ohtani. I think his injury a year ago has affected me a little bit. I don't know how much longer you can really rely on Ohtani to be a pitcher for you every fifth day. I just have to look at the previous injury, and that would factor into it. All right, we have breaking news that has just rolled in. This is according to ESPN. Raiders defensive end Carl Nassib becomes the first active NFL player to come out as gay. So, you know, they're and for the record, it's really not even that big of a story. And it shouldn't be, because, you know, it is accepted now by just about everyone. And if it's not accepted, you're best off to keep your damn mouth shut, because you're not going to be received well. I'm just thinking, if this had been 5 years ago, 7 years ago, this would have been a, you know, time stops, the world is flat. What did you just say? It's not even to me right now at this moment the story that, you know, it would have been. I think he'll be accepted in the Las Vegas locker room. and it'll be part of the conversation in the world of sports, but I think people will move on from it. You know, Esther Tuaolo, who I used to have on my show back in the mid-90s, he played here for the Jags. He came out after the fact. Who was the kid out of Iowa a couple of years ago, the defensive end that you were just telling me about off
air? Oh, Michael Sam.
Michael Sam. But I don't think Michael Sam ever made a roster. I think he was drafted, but he might have been on a practice squad or something, but never was actually – I don't think he ever played a game. I can't think of his name as well. The Celtic who announced right after he was done.
I think that was Jason Collins.
Jason Collins. And a lot of people wanted to give him – because it was always a story. Who will be the first athlete who is playing who will come on out and acknowledge the fact that they are gay? It's always happened after the fact. So this is breaking news. But again, I think the country's grown up a great deal. Congratulations. I mean, as critical as people are to the separation that we have right now, in so many different ways, whether it's, we're talking about gender, we're talking about race, there's more and more problems. I understand that there are some who, you can't fix everyone. It's far more accepted today. And I think some credit deserves to be given to a lot of people out there. I think it shows how mentally tough he is to come out and do something like this. I mean, the men's locker room has always been, their space, kind of a gladiator space where guys do guys things. And he apparently is, I haven't seen any quotes from him yet, but I'm sure he knows that. And, congratulations to him. So I think it's pretty cool. But all the negativity that we've been hearing about everything that's going on, the vaccine, this, that, whatever, I think this is a good moment for the National Football League. And, that has been announced moments ago. Carl Nassib, Penn State. Let me look him up real quick before the break here. I want to say he was selected by Cleveland. Let me see. Let me get this computer up and running. Las Vegas Raiders. All right. Let's look at their roster. Carl Nassib becomes the first active NFL player to come out as gay, announcing the news in an Instagram post while pledging $100,000 to the Trevor Project. So, again, he deserves a lot of credit for that. And I imagine there'll be a tremendous amount of support for him. He's played in 142 games, has Nassib. 20 and a half career sacks. Let's see. He played for Cleveland in 16 and 17, Tampa Bay in 18 and 19. And in 2020, he played for Las Vegas. It says here he played in 73 career games. So whatever I said earlier was wrong. 142 tackles. He is out of Penn State, 6'7", 275 pounds. Selected in the third round of the 2016 draft, number 65 overall by the Cleveland Browns. So want to get that in. Breaking news rolling in on this Monday. All right, when we come back, let's get to some of your responses on this. And I'm getting some good ones that are really rolling in that I do want to talk to you about. I think that'll be intriguing, okay, as far as the numbers and everything that has happened with this football team and what you think will happen with this football team. For instance, here's one, 3,600. Blue, the offense was so stagnant last year. One more TD a game as an average is realistic. The D only got better at one position, so I think that points against is similar. It may decrease if we have less turnovers. Yeah, I tend to agree with the way that you're thinking. Okay, still a touchdown more, 7 points more. Man, you're going to go from 19-1 to 26-1 a game. You know, I, I said 25, and I did that while honestly kind of gritting my teeth a little bit. It's like, I just think it's tough to, you mean, the long short, you know, 186 points was the difference. And let that one settle in. Jacksonville allowed 186 points more than they scored. So now we're talking about shortening that number. Scoring more, giving up less. And I do think they'll score more. As far as giving up less, yeah. But not as much as score, in my particular opinion. Anyway, appreciate that. So getting a lot of text on it. We'll come back. We'll begin our second hour with this. 641-1010 on the text line. Also on Twitter, WBALLOU1010XL.
Let's go into the night with Rick Ballew on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
All right, we have breaking news here at the studios of 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Some more breaking news?
RJ Saunders picked the winner of the 121st National Championship. John Rahm, your U.S. Open winner. I think I'm going to start referring to you as From the Tips Saunders.
From the Tips. I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, we'll think about it. We'll discuss it.
From Maybe. The tips, man.
From the tips.
I mean, your golf analysis, you nailed the PGA Championship, or you beat me, and I thought I was in perfect shape. With Colin Morikawa settling down on the greens and Brooks Koepka. It's Sean Rahm. Congratulations.
I just want everybody to know something. I'm a winner! I have finally beat Rick. Gosh, nabbit. I mean, but, you know, listen, I look at the players and I look at the odds, to be honest with you. Look at the odds and, hey, I said, why not John Rahm? They say he has nice odds to win. I'm going to choose him. It's not like I have this down to an exact science. I just choose what I see. Players that I know, Rick. I shouldn't
stop
have chose,
being so humble.
I shouldn't have chose Victor Hovland. I mean, this guy.
I got sand in my eye. I can't play anymore.
Soft! John Rahm, thanks for coming through for a brother.
Sand in the eye. I play golf with Saturday morning with the guys from GFL. Let me find it here real quick before I get back to the Jags. And smoked one of these cigars that was, I don't like smoking bold cigars on the golf course. I mean, I do, I love a bold cigar, you know, if I got a dozen drinks in me and I got a buzz going, but you know, to start off early in the day and it was a punch cigar, I think it was called Knuckle Buster. Let me find it here. I didn't tweet out much over the weekend, but I certainly tweeted that out. Let me see. It's on my Twitter page, Blue1010XL. Yes, it's the Punch Knuckle Buster. Let me tell you something, brother. I knocked my socks off. All right? And I smoke a lot of cigars. And that was bold. And I've always liked Punch. Punch is one of my go-tos. But I have to ask James Coleman if he's ever smoked one of those when he comes in here in just 1 hour. You've yet to have a cigar. We know that you had allegedly, I didn't see it, allegedly, a sip of Miller Lite.
Right. Yes. But I didn't know that. Okay, here's my thing. I didn't know that they got they let you smoke and drink at the golf course. I didn't know that. I thought, you know, that would have to be a outside
thing. You're allowed to do basically whatever you want on the golf course.
I need to go.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Now, the respectful way to do it is to buy the cocktails from the cart girl or buy them at the turn.
But they don't.
But a lot of folks sneak them in bags and everything, you know. Whatever. But cigars, yeah. I mean, you can get them there too at the club shop or clubhouse. But you purchase them. Yeah, you need to learn. You need to learn a few things. Like for instance, I got Gary Smith's a cocktail at Mr. Chubby's.
Right. Yeah.
It was a Bacardi and Diet.
Yeah.
And we're going back on the air. I say, RJ, get Schmitter over here a Bacardi and Diet. And he goes, is that two drinks? Does Bacardi come in one and the Diet Coke come in another?
I did. I'm not ashamed of it. I did.
I'm like, nah, why don't you have her mix it?
I did say that. If you want to roast me now on the text line, you can. I don't know this stuff.
It's good. It's good not to know. And you know what? Honestly, if my life didn't involve spirits, I'd probably be better off for it. I'd have a hell of a lot more money in my pocket. I just showed you my tab from Saturday night when I got after it, when I turned into a happy drunk.
Ching, ching.
$100 tip.
Oh, man. Whoever that person was a very happy camper.
$176 damage, $100. That's the way I roll, the big tipper. You play, you're from the tips, Saunders. I'm the big tipper.
You give out the tips.
All right, let's get to it. 641-1010 on the text line. Baloo, teams don't get better. They get better quarterbacks. It's that simple. And that translates into more points. We'd be happy if they average 24-plus. Better offense makes a better defense, which makes the offense better, and so on. A 5 to 6 point average increase for the offense shouldn't turn mean a 5 to 6 point decrease in defense. Let's hope that leads to a 5 to 6 increase in wins. Yeah, that's interesting, your theory there. And honestly, I don't know if it's true. I'm sure we could, you know, go back and find numbers that would support that. You know, I would like to think that, yeah, the more points that you're scoring per game means you're holding on to the football more. And hopefully in turn, that means that you're giving up less. But I don't know if that's always the case. I guess what I'm trying to say here is I have them at 25 and 28. Okay, those are my numbers. I have them going from 19.1 a game to 25 a game, and that's a big boost. I have them giving up 30.8 a game, dropping down to 28. But my point in all this is if they went from 19.1 to 25 but stayed around 30, I wouldn't be surprised in points allowed. But if it went the other way, if they stayed closer offensively to 19.1 a game but then made a drastic move defensively, they went from 30.8, let's say, to the mid-20s, yeah, I'd be very surprised by that. Now, again, I got to move in 9 points. Oh, I'm getting the obligatory stop talking about it. It's a non-story. Why does it matter who he likes to sleep? I gave it 3 or 4 minutes. It was a breaking story. There's always going to be some of them. No, I'm not going to read this. No, I'm not going to read that. No, I'm not going to. I can't even read these now. There still are a lot of sick people out there. And all I got to do is look at the text line. It's there for y'all to see. 28-35 Blue drink after the round or birdie make a bogey. Yeah, I can turn a birdie into a bogey pretty fast. All right, a lot of these, we've gotten away from it now because I mentioned the story. People have taken upon it to respond to that, and virtually everyone that I've received is not presentable for air. So I'm going to leave it alone. But if you want to, you can get back to us on it. What did you come up with now? 19.1 offensively last year, 30th in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm going from 19 to 25.
That's exactly what I did.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm going to go, I don't know why I want to stay at 30. I don't know why. I feel like there's so many things that have to go right for this team. I'll go down to 27 a game. I'll go down to 27 because I feel like the defense is going to be more rested with a Trevor Lawrence, because Trevor Lawrence is going to be able to keep this offense on the field longer and it's going to be able to take a lot more time. It just seemed to me that the defense was always gassed last year because right when they're getting off the field, they're getting right back on it. So if this defense can be a little bit more rested, then I think you're probably in a better position to where you're allowing the opposing offense not to score as much because you're not as tired. So, I mean, we'll see, but so many things have to go right. So right now I'll put him at 25 points a game that will score per game, and I think that will give up about 27 a night.
Well, that's about an 11-point swing, right? 31 to 27 is 4. 19 to 25 is 6. That's a 10-point swing. I had it at 9. We both had the same numbers, moving up offensively from 19.1 to 25. I have him going from 30.8 to 28 defensively. You have him going to 27 defensively. So we're thinking alike here. But I mean, that's a 10-point difference from this year. That is enormous. And you know, I never really thought about it this way until I always give credit where credit's due. He's a frequent guest on my show, but John Clayton, you know, a few years ago, it was even after the AFC Championship game. It was either the year before it or the year after it. It was probably the year before it, but he was really doing things this way, and it got me thinking. And you know, I've always kind of looked at it this way ever since I had that conversation with John. He said something along the lines of, you know, the defense improved by like 6.5 points 1 year. Now can you get your offense to do the same thing? And the Jaguars did, because if you go back to the 2017 season, I think Jacksonville was fourth in scoring defense, and I want to say they were fifth or tied for fifth in scoring offense. And they were one of only a few teams in the NFL to be in the top five in both categories. That doesn't happen a lot. You know, most teams, even the very good ones out there, their offense is better than their defense or vice versa. It's very difficult to find a consistent team that ranks in the top five offensively in scoring offense and in the top five in scoring defense. It just doesn't happen. You know, you either win in a shootout or you win in a grind. But that got me really on this, and I thought it made a tremendous amount of sense when John Clayton said it, and that's where I am now. I mean, you're talking about 12 points. Okay? How much closer can you get? I think it's going to be a little bit easier offensively than it is going to be defensively. It says, hey, what do you have a turnovers as? What were we? I will get up again. I think they were -7, -8 for the year. Allow me this break. I'll come back and I'll mention that on the other side. It was a terrible year for the takeaway, you know, turnover to takeaway ratio. And again, you go back to the year that they made the AFC Championship game. They were in plus figures, and I want to say the defense that year scored maybe 6 touchdowns. You know, pick sixes, fumble recoveries. I want to say as a team they scored 6. So, I mean, just give that some consideration. That's 36 points. Well, over 16 games, I mean, you're actually getting something offensive production points scored by your defense, and the Jaguars were able to do that back in the 2017 season. All right, let's I got a few more of these coming up. We'll get back to it. 641-1010, that is the number. Again, interested with you on this. No doubt, to me, you know, this is what it really comes down to. Yeah? You know, everything today is mathematical. Right? Everything today is about analytics. I'm sure that's what they're thinking. How can we score an extra touchdown a game? How can we give up less a game? That's the only way that, you know, you're going to be relevant. And when you allow 186 points more than you score, which the Jaguars did in 16 games last year, you're going to go 1-15. So if you were to move that by 9 points, let me do a little math here before the break. Let me whip out the calculator. 9 times 16 and going off last year's numbers, not this year's numbers, okay? That's 144 points. All right, so that's two. So, you know, I'm talking about them going from allowing 186 points for the year, the plus minus, minus 186, to minus 42. Look how much closer that is. You know, you're in games. If that's all you're being outscored for by the year, you're going to win 5, 6, 7, 8 football games. And if you have the numbers higher than I do, higher than Saunders does, you're going to win more games. All right, more of that coming up. 641-1010. Let me check real quick what's going on here with Jake DeGrom and that historic earn run average. Let's see here. Braves and Mets. Ooh, the Braves get to him for a couple of runs. Mets up 4-2. DeGrom is out. He never came back to pitch the sixth inning. All right, so they went to Lugo, and he gave up two runs right out of the gate. DeGrom, you know, remember, he missed a start, and he must have been on a pitch count today because he only threw 70 pitches. 5 innings, 1 hit, struck out 6, walked 2. His ERA sits at 0.50. Right now, Mets up 4-2, a 2-run homer by Albies. For the Braves, who are scuffling as of late, still trying to get to 500, to 3 games under at 33-36. We've played 6 innings in Queens, New York. All right, much more to get from you on the other side. Good to have you with us on this Monday with RJ Saunders. I'm Rick Ballew.
Let's go into the night with Rick Ballew on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, it was 8. The turnover takeaway ratio a year ago, minus 8. That's a half turnover to game average. Not good. I looked up numbers from the, you know, AFC Championship game season to last season. And that is a huge factor. Jacksonville was plus 10 in the turnover ratio the year they went to the AFC Championship game. Again, minus 8 last year. And you look at time of possession last year, 27 minutes, 51 seconds. The year that they went to the game, 32 minutes, 19 seconds. They've always been a ridiculously highly penalized football team. I just have a gut feeling that under Urban Meyer, that is going to change drastically. Now, you know, a lot of these defensive penalties nowadays are bogus. You know, we protect the offensive players. It's an offensive game. You know, you really ring someone up, they're going to throw a flag and pass interference and some of that stuff. I really don't blame the defensive player. You know, yeah. It must be difficult to be told that you got to calm things down. What I have a problem with is the false starts. Okay? You know, stupid penalties by your offensive line. The offensive line right now, by a lot of people, feels like the secret weapon. It's almost like they've got a little something, you know, hidden under their sleeve. Like, just wait. This offensive line this year, now if they have a quarterback, it's going to gel. It's going to come together. All right, well, then let's also eliminate the stupid penalties. I mean, Juwan Taylor's the master at that at right tackle. He gets a false start every game. Can't happen anymore. So, yeah, those numbers, pretty impressive. No question about it. Let me see how many defensive touchdowns they actually had. I think they had 6 or 7 that year. Let's see. Is that right? I only got 2. That's on interceptions. I got 1 by Barry Church. I got 1 by Telvin. Didn't they have some fumble recoveries for a touchdown? two touchdowns? Nah, they had more than that. They had some fumble recoveries. I don't know why I can't find a statistic on it. Well, it says here that Yannick Ngakoue had a touchdown. Dante Fowler Jr. had a touchdown. Kelvin Smith had two touchdowns. And Miles Jack had a touchdown. The aforementioned Barry Church had a touchdown. How could we ever forget the Calais Campbell touchdown? So, you know, you look at, and Jadon Mickens returned one. So, I mean, you just look at this defense. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You had 7 defensive touchdowns. Yeah? I mean, incredible. And that has not been the case for the Jaguars as of late. They, you know, and teams are still throwing the ball a decent amount against Jacksonville. As I said, the books, it's not like the offense, which was so pass-oriented a year ago. I mean, they passed the football 616 times. They only ran it 337 times. And James Robinson did so 240 of them. After that, the next running back was Dari Ogunbowale, who ran it 32 times. I mean, Chris Thompson, 7. Craig Reynolds ran one. I'm still trying to figure out where I was when Craig Reynolds got a carry. Devon Ezigbo had a carry. That's it. So, yeah, that is a major factor. One pick six a year ago, that was Joe Schobert. I mean, overall, you know, led the team in interceptions. It was Joe Schobert. He had 3. Sidney Jones had 2. Andrew Wingard had 2. He had 1 for Jared Wilson, 1 for Daniel Thomas, who I may add, you know, there's been a lot written about Daniel Thomas, a lot said about Daniel Thomas. He had a really good camp. There's some people who believe that he is going to be really involved in that rotation. And that's saying a lot for the Jaguars, considering, you know, they really address safety. We know they went out and they spent a lot of money on Rashawn Jenkins. They also went out and brought in Rudy Ford, who they believe is going to help out an awful lot on special teams. He's one of the fastest gunners in the NFL, so that's going to be a factor there. On special teams. You know, Andre Sisko is a guy who hasn't been able to go 100%. He's battling back from that torn ACL. They love him. You know, they happen to think he was perhaps the best safety in football at Syracuse with 13 career picks before he went down with that injury. So they've addressed it. They brought back Josh Jones. But Daniel Thomas is a guy that a lot of people are high on. And one other interception a year ago, that was C.J. Henderson and Josh Jones. So, you know, as a team, you only had 12 picks in 16 games. That is not going to get it done. No question about it. All right. Let me ask you a question. Who do you blame? Doc Rivers? Ben Simmons? Because before you answer, to me, this has always been a fascinating question.
Right.
Here I am tonight again looking at what Jacksonville didn't do in the fourth quarter against New England in the AFC Championship game.
Right.
They were passive. They were predictable.
Right.
They didn't try to win.
Right.
Okay? They tried to run off the clock. I blame coaching there. I don't blame the players. I blame coaching.
All right.
Doc Rivers is getting ripped by, what, Josh Smith, former players, you know.
Yep.
Simmons didn't shoot.
Right.
We saw what Embiid said at the end of the game.
Right.
Who do you blame, player or coach?
On this one, I kind of have to go with Ben Simmons on this one. The only reason is because in a game 7, I mean, you really can't be passive. I mean, you know, cards are all on the table. I think Doc understood that, you know, I may have to take you out for 2-3 minutes because of that dumb rule that they have where you can intentionally foul, put Ben Simmons on the line. He doesn't want to shoot those free throws. So I'll take him out. I'll put in, you know, Shake Milton for 2-3 minutes, put Ben Simmons back in the game. He'll finish it out. I think Doc did probably everything that he could to make Ben Simmons comfortable. And Ben Simmons has these demons of he's just scared to shoot the ball. And I understand that he wants to be this Magic Johnson, Penny Hardaway 2.0. But in a series in which I really feel shouldn't have gone 7 games, congratulations to the Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
But and also for a team that has been questioned regarding can you have Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid on the same team, I feel like this was Ben Simmons' chance to shut up everybody. He didn't do it, so I have to put more of the blame on him than Doc Rivers.
Okay. Huge upset.
Yes.
Atlanta.
Absolutely.
But what about Milwaukee over New York?
Oh, over Brooklyn, yes.
I mean, yeah. What is going on right now in the East?
Injuries. I think, you know, that was a huge thing. However, I'll also say Kevin Durant, which we spoke about this on the podcast that we did.
Plug your podcast.
The Producers in the Paint podcast. It's right now on 1010XL.com. Go to Buzzsprout.com. Type in 1010XL. You can listen to it there. Did an interview with Lee Ellis, who's formerly of the Starters, and all those guys that were on that show now have their own podcast on the Athletic NBA, and where he's saying, you know, Kevin Durant is, you know, a big toe from winning an entire series on his own, and Mike Budenholzer is probably out of a job in Milwaukee after that, but, you know, congratulations to Giannis. Giannis was able to do his thing as well, so I think Brooklyn did all that they could do. I think that we saw a lot from Kevin Durant. I think if James Harden is probably at 75-80%, they probably win that game. After that shot, I mean, you could feel it. I could feel it through my TV. Milwaukee wanted no part of that overtime.
No.
No part of the overtime. And you didn't allow yourself to say, hey, let's calm down and let's end this now. And Brooklyn didn't do that. Kevin Durant was completely gassed. He didn't get it done. I think Milwaukee, this is probably an easy trip to the NBA Finals, but we've seen stranger things.
Criticism on these NBA players are just amazing, and I know it happens, you know, in every sport. I was, pretty down on members of the Boston Bruins not getting it done against the New York Islanders. Not being able to put the puck in the net, you know, turning the puck over way too much in their own zone. It just feels like in a lot of instances, though, in the NBA, people are so quick to define. And it really feels like there's a lot of villains right now. I think in sports in general, I mean, growing up, being a villain was kind of a cool thing. I mean, Mr. October, Reggie Jackson, was a huge villain, okay? Pedro Martinez, Roger Clemens, huge villains. Now everyone from, you know, Bryson DeChambeau to Brooks Koepka to several baseball players to several basketball players. Look at Jalen Ramsey. He's running his mouth all the time, saying some of the most ridiculous things. It just feels, and I think a lot of it is self-inflicted because of social media.
Yes.
But it just feels like there are way more villains right now. You used to have to earn being a villain. You had to be a superstar. Or if you weren't a superstar, you were a Bill Laimbeer who earned it that way.
Right.
Now it seems like every fan base with every team, they're just finding villains.
I'm a villain. Kevin Durant, I think he got his villain status the same way LeBron James did with this whole super team thing. I think for the both of them, I think that they probably understand now that not everybody's going to like them. I think that they were in a point in their careers when, you know, everyone was saying they're a villain. They tried to live up to that status. I don't think that they do it anymore now. But yes, now in today's game, I mean, look at Trae Young. Trae Young, this is, I think, their first time in the playoffs with Trae Young as their point guard.
Hey, look at his shirt last night.
Yeah, I mean, And now, all of a sudden, is Trae Young the next New York Knicks villain? Do you understand how long Reggie Miller had to play against the Knicks?
And he had to beat,
had to beat the Knicks before they said he's the villain of the Knicks?
But he shows up last night in the press conference with a shirt already made with him dunking over Embiid.
Oh, yeah, John Collins.
Yeah, John Collins.
Yeah, so, come on. It takes time. You don't all of a sudden, you had a couple of good games, and all of a sudden, I'm a villain. No, you earn it over time.
Yeah.
Thickening.
Too much of it. I haven't taken the deep dive in the NBA like you do. It's your favorite sport. I've clearly told you that, there are four other sports I love more. But I read everything in the Globe over the weekend, the Boston Globe. All of a sudden, you look at the Boston Celtics, they're making it seem like that thing is beyond chaotic, that it's totally dysfunctional right now. The locker room, the entire building in Boston.
I think I saw a report. They said Blake Griffin was interested in going to Boston.
You read that, yeah.
And they said, it's really dysfunctional here. So, what does that mean down the line for a guy like Jason Tatum? Do you sign the Supermax? He probably does, but do you sign the Supermax or do you say, it's really dysfunctional here. So Boston has a lot that they have to figure out there. Dallas is going to be another team too, because now your young star in Luka Doncic, he's saying that, he's not saying, but there are reports lingering about that there is some tension between Dallas and the young star Luka Doncic. So dysfunction in organizations with young talent and the mobility that you have now in the NBA and in any sport. Look at Mookie Betts. The dysfunction there. And he just, asked to leave and head out. Damian Lillard almost the same way. So I don't know where the dysfunction comes from in organizations, but they better figure some things out and quickly.
There'll be no dysfunction tonight. Game 5 in Tampa. Islanders 2, Lightning 2. The very important Game 5. Tampa favored -180 to the dollar. That begins in about 25 minutes, right when we get off the air. I am certainly very excited about that. Should be a lot of fun. And then late night tonight, I'm going to settle into what I think is turning into one of the great rivalries, finally, after all these years of Major League Baseball. That's the Los Angeles Dodgers against the San Diego Padres. Late night, look forward to that. DeGrom did hold on. It's the first of two today. Apparently, is it? Why did it end in 7? Yeah, they have another game coming up here at 8:10. So DeGrom does get the victory. He went 5 innings and allowed 1 hit. Okay, his earned run average falls to 0.50. He is now 7-2 on the season. The Braves fall to 4 games under 500. The good news is the numbers are ridiculous on splitting a doubleheader. I would like to see what the money is tonight on Atlanta, because, again, I don't wager, and I probably should, because I nailed the U.S. Open at -6. I told you, I told everyone who was listening, -6.
Right on the button.
Did I not?
You did. You hit it right on the button.
Atlanta -135. Man, that's easy money. Okay? Who's the last team to sweep a doubleheader? It happens less than 20% of the time. It's like one of those unwritten rules in baseball. If you're going to make us play 2 games in 1 day, here's what we got for you. A split. Man, if I was wagering, I would be loading up on the Atlanta Braves and Ian Anderson tonight. No, not the flute player from Jethro Tull, but the right-hander for the Atlanta Braves. So there you have it. One other note, it's going to happen tomorrow. Okay? The Tampa Bay Rays are calling up their number one prospect, Wander Franco. He's a 20-year-old shortstop. He's been playing some third base as of late. This is like another one of these 5-tool guys that can absolutely do everything, and they're going to throw him right into it. Tomorrow, he's expected to play his first ever Major League Baseball game, Tampa hosting Boston. That'll be tomorrow. But, I mean, this is considered the number one prospect in baseball. And Tampa Bay has called him up. He will play tomorrow for the very first time. So, yeah, I love the young talent. You asked me earlier, who do I like better, Vlad Guerrero or Ohtani? I just love seeing these young kids play. And this is going to be another one that I'm certainly going to have my eye on starting tomorrow night. Wander Franco. All right, when we come back, put the final touches on this one. Get you ready for the Sports Den. 641-1010, best way to reach us. That is on the text line.
Let's go into the night with Rick Ballew on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
I was officially announced on Friday, but it's getting a little bit of play here on this Monday. It was part of a, I guess, a news dump on Friday, but the Jags did sign Laquan Treadwell, the former first-round draft pick out of Ole Miss. They did part with John Vea Johnson, so... You know, I think that's the strongest position group on this football team. Again, I didn't have Philip Dorsett making the team the last time I went 1 through 53. I thought he had a very good camp. We'll see what Treadwell can do here now. And will the Jags add anyone else here in the month of June? We will see. Camp is expected to start on July 27th. All right, final moments before the Sports Den. I haven't had an opportunity to get into it today because this is just been too much going on. So I have a feeling I'll dive into it tomorrow night, but I'm sure you're aware more changes are coming in the world of the NCAA. The Supreme Court today, it was unanimous. They side with former college players. You know, it's time for these collegiate athletes to be compensated. And listen to this quote from Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Quote, the NCAA is not above the law. The NCAA couches its arguments for not paying student-athletes in innocuous labels. The labels cannot disguise the reality. The NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America. End of quote. A major victory. And, you know, I guess the ruling here is if you can prove that the monies that come in benefits their education at said college university, it is going to be allowed. So, you know, 9-0 as far as the vote, very good. I'm going to be very interested in all of the, you know, the sidebar stories that come out of this and how different states are going to react when it comes to handling it the way that they do. To me, my only concern is this. You know, I'm for it. I never was for really years and years and years. I always looked at college as amateur athletics. And, you know, they get a free education as someone who was on scholarship. Like a lot of things in life, I found myself changing with this. I see no problem at all with these players being able to get paid if they're signing a jersey that has their name on it or signing a photograph that is them. I mean, they should. I remember when I was over in Tallahassee and, you know, when they announced they were going pro, I would do a radio show with signings with Derek Brooks and Zach Crockett and Warwick Dunn and guys. And it was the first time in, you know, they didn't set it up themselves. They had a handler, but it was the first time that they were getting, what, 10, 15, 20 bucks an autograph, whatever it was, in the early 90s. But what I'm concerned about is state laws and how they're going to handle it. Okay? What if, you know, Florida's like all for it and yeah, they're going to up the ante, but then all of a sudden Georgia's not or South Carolina's not. It could really affect recruiting. I mean, if you're a young 4 or 5 star stud and you can pick any school and you know that this state is going to allow you to be able to do this, this university is going to allow you to do it, and this one is going to hold firm against it, even though the Supreme Court came forward today and announced what they announced, it could crush them. So this is a huge step forward for players as far as compensation, but I just get the feeling like everything else, it's not over yet. There'll be another loophole in here somewhere. There'll be another deal where, you know, it is going to be appealed. And anyway, but we'll see. I'm gonna get into this tomorrow night. I'm going to talk with a few people, read a little bit more on it, and look forward to making that part of things coming up on Tuesday.
Now, the two-minute drill, brought to you by Tire Outlet. Keeping the rubber on the road with wholesale prices and premium service. Tire Outlet, Jacksonville's largest locally owned automotive repair shop.
Denny Thompson is here.
How's your weekend, man?
Great weekend.
Yeah,
fun weekend. How about you?
It was good. It was good, yeah. It was really good. I enjoyed Guns N' Roses a lot.
So your first time going?
No. It's our third time.
Okay.
So one of my favorite weekends of the year. So we had a great time. We'll get into a little bit of that tonight.
I guess James dominated by the Jacksonville folks, huh?
What's that?
Jacksonville dominant?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, dominated. I was reading James's social media on Saturday night. Yeah.
And it was like, it was good boxing for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was, they didn't pull, you know, 30 fighters. They pulled 9. And these guys and guys and gals knew what they were doing. So it was a great night, a great event. So we had a great time. We'll get into a little bit of that tonight. It's funny because I'm actually going to start where you ended.
Yeah.
We're going to start by talking about name, image, and likeness. And what it actually like entails and what it means. And I'm being educated every single day with the guys that we train and what this is looking like. It's interesting, man.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. It's a game changer. And on a lot of levels, for me anyway, it's something that when I look at it, it's like, how were we not already doing this
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways?
I changed, yeah. I mean.
Same.
I used to say no way.
Yeah, same. But it was never presented to me like this.
No.
Up until the last couple of years.
Well,
it was always presented as pay the players.
You know, the first time I heard about it was when I was in high school because Doug Flutie was making millions and millions and millions for BC.
Mm-hmm.
He made more money for that school than, and they're like, how can Doug Flutie not get a dime of it?
Right.
And then, of course, around here, these are football blue buds factories, not like BC, which, you know, even when Flutie was winning a Heisman, that was on page 6 of the Boston Globe. It's a pro town.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's you know, you look at some of these players and the amount of money that they have made for the university. I don't know how they're going to be able to separate this from the superstars to the guys who are lucky to be on scholarship. To me, that's another issue.
Well, I think that's the beautiful thing about it is I think it's going to separate itself. And that's one of the things I'm going to open with is it's in a lot of ways is capitalism at its finest. If you're good, you get paid like you're good. If you're average, you're going to get paid like you're average. If you're not any good, you know what? You're not going to get any money. And we're seeing that kind of shake down now as we get closer to the start date of name, image, and likeness. And I think there's still a lot of questions that the NCAA needs to answer, but it's not in there. This isn't – the ball's not in that court.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so for them, like, it's gonna, they're going to have to adapt more than rule, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. I don't know enough about this law and what has been said where can universities in other states, regardless of this, do it the way they want to do it. I mean, I don't know the answer to those particular questions because it's all so brand new. I mean, I would think around here, Florida State, Miami, have at it. But what about some other schools? I don't know the answer to those questions.
I think most of the states have gotten on board. Now, there are different start dates, and they absolutely are being used in recruiting.
Didn't Georgia throw up a fight that I read about recently?
Yeah, they're on board. I think they start.
They went 180.
July 1.
A few months ago, they were opposed.
Yeah, they start July 1. In fact, there's already contracts that's been signed with kids at Georgia that they'll start getting paid right away. So it's very interesting. I've been forced, Rick, to learn about it because of what I do outside of here, and it has become not only part of the recruiting game, but almost just a part of, like, we like to think of ourselves at Six Points as we're full service. Like, it's like, you know, guys need oil changes. All right, we got to connect for you there. We've had to adapt to this. We've had to get with apparel companies. We've had to get with things like that because these guys are 18, 19, 20 years old. If you start letting them introduce that clutter into their life, they're not going to perform on the field. And so that's kind of what we're here for, is we're going to train you. We're going to take care of everything off the field so your focus can stay on the field. And it almost is a business manager type proposition in some ways with some of the more well-known players.
Yeah. It's going to be fascinating. I mean, right now you got open free agency with the transfer portal. Now you add this. Boy, man, I can just see the luring of freshmen and sophomores.
It's already happening.
And you know, the worry used to be boosters and those who own companies, $100 handshakes. Don't pay these players. Don't get caught. You can, you know, you're selfishly doing it to try to help your school, but then you end up hurting your school if you get pinched. I wonder how all that's going to fit in now, where you can actually legally pay them something.
Well, your favorite college football player on your favorite team is going to be making six figures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to start here in the next month.
Right.
Like, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't think it's going to do anything negative to the sport, but it's already being used in recruiting circles. But all of your top 25 teams are kind of on a level playing field here.
So who's going to make the most money in sports? Is it Rattler at Oklahoma? Is it Sam Howell? That's a basketball school.
Yeah.
Is Sam Howell? I mean, is most money going to come from the –
You're kind of getting into my first segment here.
Well, then I'll leave you at
it. It's the only show prep I've done.
Yeah. It may be JT Daniels at Georgia, for crying out loud, if they win a national title.
They've got a freshman quarterback who hasn't played a snap yet, who's already got a contract.
All right. Sounds good. It's coming up right now. Denny Thompson and company. That'll do it for us. Thank you as always. Again, I don't check the text line now if the show is over. If you want to get a hold of me, the best way to do so is on Twitter. That is Ballou1010XL. For RJ Saunders, my name is Rick Ballou. I'll talk to you tomorrow after Helmets and Heels.